Welcome to our Commander's Panel series, where Senior Master Sergeant Kaiser interviews two full-time commanders and one part-time drill status guardsman commander, asking questions that were submitted by airmen at the 122nd Fighter Wing. In part one, the commanders talk about their roles and responsibilities, how they make far-reaching decisions that affect lots of people working under them, things they wish they knew before becoming a commander, and personal development tools that have shaped their leadership philosophies. Don't miss part two in this series, where the commanders discuss the art of managing people, expectations, and communication within their organizations. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to review and share the show.
This is the official podcast of the 122nd Fighter Wing. Views and opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of the 122nd Fighter Wing, Air National Guard, or United States government. No endorsement of any person or business is ever intended.
Welcome back, Black Snakes. You're stuck with me again, your host, Senior Master Sergeant Leslie Kaiser, while Lieutenant Rogers is out doing great Black Snake things. Excited for another drill, which you guessed it, another podcast episode is coming your way. So we really wanted to close up the panel series that was requested and bring on today three guests who are commanders on the base. And we'll get to how long they've been out here on the base. We don't want to show their age a little too early, but collectively, they are all prior enlisted with various experience of careers on the base. And being prior enlisted, now they're leading the charge in our Air Force, being our commanders. Commanders can oversee a flight, squadron, group, wing, state. And with that, today, our guests are Major Bohatchy, Major Pence, my boss, not biased at all, and Major Shelton. So Major Bohatchy, why don't you kick us off and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Hi, good morning. My name's Major Cody Bohatchy. I'm the commander of the maintenance operations flight and it's part of the maintenance group. We handle mainly the scheduling for aircraft maintenance, training, unit deployment issues, as well as analysis of data and engine management stuff as well. So a little about me. I'm a traditional officer. I come out here on the weekends and keep up with what I can during the week. In my civilian job, I'm a firefighter paramedic over in Ohio, so I'm a little bit of a drive away, so that makes it kind of a challenge. I've been out here since about 2007. I spent 9 years as an engine mechanic. I worked both F-16s and A-10s here at Fort Wayne, and then commissioned in 2013.
Major Pence?
Well, thanks, Leslie, for having us. I'm the 122nd Maintenance Squadron Commander. My history, I've been a Black Snake my whole career. So in 2002, I came in as an F-16 avionics troop. And then during the conversion to A-10s, I transitioned to a crew chief and worked in the R&R shop. I went to NCO Academy, had some success there, and was a Levito Award winner. And at the time, the base commander asked me what else I would like to do. So I had an opportunity to come over and be the community engagement manager in public affairs, which just showed me another side of the base, which was really awesome. He had a flight path for me. That one went the enlisted route, one went the officer route, and I decided to go the officer route. So I went back to being a DSG, went out in the civilian world, worked for BAE Systems, worked for a startup company, and then started up my own business, and then at the same time commissioned as a maintenance officer. I did that for a while, and then I came out to support the 2019 air show and was the public affairs officer for that year period. And then right after that, went over to the MOF as the commander, full-time again, and then into the MXS. So kind of a deviating path of my career to see both sides of things.
Awesome. Ma'am?
Hi, Leslie. Thank you for having me. So I started out in 2001, enlisted out here as a baby Black Snake, and was a personnelist. I got out here full-time and did personnel for a while, and then recruiting and retention. Really loved it. Really loved helping people. Kind of inspired me to want to get a commission. And I found that with the Illinois Air National Guard. So I commissioned over there in 2011 and was their air operations group executive officer. Also was a AFOR A1 officer, so that's Air Force Forces, or like a staff, an A staff officer, and their Joint Task Force A1 or J1 officer. So did that for a couple years. Loved it. Great place. Wanted to be closer to home, and the director of personnel position was open back here in the fort. So came back in late 2015, did that for a while, and then became the Force Support Squadron Commander. Awesome squadron, did a lot of cool things with them. And as of late, this past March, I moved over to the Logistics Readiness Squadron. So a very different mission, but full of lots of cool people and doing cool things. So happy to be here.
Yeah, it's so good to have you guys. And I think I did some quick math and it was like 60-ish years, so not too bad. It's an average of 21 as an age, right? We'll take it. And Major Shelton, I don't know if you remember when I came in 2010 from the Georgia Guard, you actually were part of that retention team that brought me on board. So
nice.
Thank you.
That.
Yes. Yes. So I'm just going to kick us off. Commanders have a lot of responsibilities, as we talked about offline. I learned at First Sergeant 2.0 course, you guys have 23,000 responsibilities. I don't know how that makes you all feel, but that sounds like a lot of pressure. Having 23,000 responsibilities, does that lean hard on you guys? Do you feel the pinch, the pressure?
It didn't until you told us we had 23,000.
Sorry about
that. That wasn't in the pamphlet.
I kept looking in the AFI and couldn't find it.
100% agree. I was way more worried after reading that than I was before.
So. There you go. Okay, good. As long as we got that all the way for you guys. So in that responsibility and that charge you guys are entrusted with, the AFI, our Air Force instruction 1-2, is what really drives home the commander's position. Can you guys kind of tell us a little bit about that AFI and what we can take from that?
Air Force instruction 1-2, that was handed to me when I first started as a commander. It's a very short instruction, but I feel like it's very helpful and help guiding a new commander. It basically explains your four different responsibilities that you have. Basically how we design the way that we inspect and the way that we format our units now. That's the way that the Air Force is leading. Executing the mission, leading the people, managing resources, and improving the unit. Those four areas, they seem very broad. There's lots of things that fall underneath that. I know for me, that's where I look at as I get ready to prep for my weekends and talking with my airmen as we're looking at what things are we doing to fit in those different areas. And it's how we set up our goals. It's how we look at our battle rhythm throughout the next 12 months. So it's helpful in setting up a good framework for your squadron.
Yeah.
I think it was shocking that how short that AFI was the first time you see it. But then when you look at everything that is built into how we operate day to day, it does fall within one of those categories. So we have built-in programs, we have built-in operations and procedures that lead us to meeting those requirements. And then I find that you can kind of shift every once in a while to this one is important at this point in time, so we need to put effort towards this. And not that any of them are not important, but you try to keep them all in the back of your mind as you're making decisions. But going forward, you may have to focus on one area or another based on where your squadron's at the time.
Major Bohachi, how would you define improve the unit? There's some gray area, but ethically or at your standard and the Air Force standard, how would you define that?
Really, it comes down to like what Major Pence was just talking about. That balance of choosing which of those things is important at the time really kind of defines the direction that we need to go, whether that be people, equipment, money, assets, whatever that looks like, and what direction we need to push towards is kind of how we set up the decision-making process. I know specifically like for the maintenance group, when we sit down and look at our goals, they're all based specifically on those areas with the intent of looking at where our shortfalls are and how do we improve those and what that looks like.
And it's kind of a ripple effect, right? You guys don't operate alone as a lone wolf out there trying to figure it out on your own. You have a team. And once those higher goals are established, you guys can kind of go from there. What does a squadron or flight commander, how do they get mentored and more leadership knowledge? Are you just thrown into the role? I mean, you're selected, you're boarded, right? Like, there's the officialness of it, but how does that ongoing mentorship continue?
In some ways, yes. I mean, you go from not being a commander to a commander on day one, and there are expectations that come with that. And there's mentorship prior to that that you should be able to kind of step in and at least know where to find things or who to go to. Frankly, I would not get anywhere without the people I have that work for me and I work for. I go to them all the time with things and advice, and it's too much to manage by myself. We talked about 23,000 things, probably at least 22,500 of them I might not even know about. So I've got to go to somebody else for those answers to figure that out. So knowing who those people are and using those is really kind of the key to success and probably any job out here.
Sure. Good job on your 500 accomplishments.
I'm not sure it's even 500, Frank.
Would you guys like to add anything?
Honestly, as a commander, this is probably the position where I've had the most mentoring. Once you get started in there, you're right, you're kind of thrown into it. And you look around and you're like, okay, who can help me? Your fellow commanders, your fellow peers on the base, so like squadron commanders, we help each other. I don't think people know how often we call each other. Like, hey, I'm dealing with this new situation. Have you seen anything like that? Yeah, usually somewhere out here we've had some sort of experience where we can at least help guide each other to get on the right path to then make decisions. But then you get mentorship from your senior leaders, from our group commanders, our wing commander, and that's all very valuable because of the experience they've had. And then the mentorship comes up through the enlisted ranks. And I know that my chiefs mentor me on a daily basis, making sure that my decision-making is always taken in the enlisted perspective and the understanding that of how it's going to impact the squadron realistically. It may look good, you know, as like an ideal, but it may not be realistic in it. So they do a really great job of mentoring me to make sure that these are realistic expectations.
Sure.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I would say that this is, you know, I've been a commander for a while, and I would say at this point in time, this is probably the best relationship I've had with all of the squadron commanders and, you know, DOs that work out here. Every single one of them, if I text them, hey, I got a question, or can you help me with that? Everyone is a quick phone call away, more than willing to help, more than willing to give some advice. That is really nice to know that you have a team to help you mentor you through some of those tougher situations. I do think it's really important to get mentorship, obviously, also from our enlisted force. I've had a lot of tough conversations with chiefs that, you know, I want honest feedback. And so they do, and they provide that because a lot of times, well, most of the time, they've been in that squadron longer than you have. So they're able to give you that expert advice and also some of that insight from the airmen.
What goes through your mind when you're making these huge decisions? You've got inspection, resources, mission, improving the unit, which is, I mean, all people are in those. How do you guys navigate those thought processes? Do they keep you up at night?
I try to think when I'm looking at a big decision, like, what's the impact of this 12 months from now, 5 years from now? I feel like that's really important as a commander to take that step back and look at, hey, you know, this decision, you know, has this immediate impact. We're all going to see that. But what's the impact of, you know, funding this training or funding, you know, some equipment buys and different things? Like, is this going to help us long term to go and do that? Or, you know, maybe moving full-time resources to a different shop. You know, maybe it might hurt this one shop for a little bit, but long-term, is this better for the squadron? So there are times, yeah, it does keep you up a little bit, and you think about it, is that the right decision? Was it not the right decision? And I think that's where, you know, every time I've hired a chief, I've always told him when I'm running a squadron, it's a 50-50 relationship. I need him or her to be very transparent with me, and we run this together. Because these decisions, I may be gone and they may be stuck with whatever those decisions are. And it's important for us because we're not in the moment, in the thick of it, to be looking ahead when we make those decisions.
Right.
You have to filter it through something that you kind of always stick to. And so for me, being later in my career, like all of us sitting around here with 20 plus years and we're still continuing to serve, the opportunities that I'm going to have are a lot less to go fight our nation's battles, but the legacy that we have to leave is, did we prepare our airmen for the battles that they're going to face? Because there are young airmen out here that are going to do another 20 or 30 years they're going to face battles that we haven't fought. So with the current situation in the world, the challenges that we have, that's what I filter those decisions through. Are we doing this to best prepare our airmen to face our nation's toughest battles, which are coming?
It's a lot to take in, and this is all before drill. So what does the drill weekend even look like for you guys? Is it Friday, Saturday, Sunday? Is it 24/7? What does drill look like?
As the DSG commander of the room, I'll provide my different example probably, because I know they're preparing probably even earlier in the week. For me at home, drill week usually starts out with at least getting sort of caught up on emails. So sometime Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, I'll fire up my computer, give it like 24 hours to boot up and do all its updates that it didn't get. So, and then get back to it and start going through kind of some emails and at least get a general idea of what's going on. So this is all at home. This is when I have free time, trying to just stay on top of things because it is just too much to come out and do in 2 days. So obviously it's Friday morning as we're recording this. That's pretty typical. I usually get here Friday morning, spend the day kind of catching up. It's my chance to get around and talk to all the shops and also get some of the requirements done before things get too crazy on drill weekend as far as stuff that needs reported or any of those mandatory things that kind of have to get done that get put off because I'm not here.
Sure.
Or don't have access to them. So
you have those conversations with your chief and shirt in between the month too?
I do. I have a long list of text messages between the chief. Luckily, the shirt doesn't have to get a hold of me too much, so that's good. But we certainly have numbers, and there's no issues if anything comes up, if anybody needs to get a hold of me. And they all have my number. Luckily, I have a small flight, so that's very practical. They know we've set out kind of how those expectations work. But if they need to get a hold of me, they have my number. They know how, and it does happen on occasion.
Sure. It's just prepping you for bigger and better things. For our full-time force, what does that look like for you guys?
I feel like drill week, you know, it's kind of the week before the big football game. So, you know, you're doing all the things, getting everyone around. I feel like Tuesday afternoon is when it starts to get busy because we start doing our group meetings on Wednesdays. Thursday, we have our squadron meetings. Friday, do a chief and shirt sync. And then we hit the ground running on Saturday. You know, I always tell my folks on Thursday when we do our pre-RSD, the point of us being out here full time is to make things, is to get things ready for our drill weekend. We're here to organize, train, and equip our drill status guardsmen. And so if you're not here doing those things, you know, we need to be thinking of that. So, you know, what training do you have arranged? What appointments do you need to make sure that they get to? So then that way, when they get here and they do the, you know, 15 reboots of their computer, they already are ready to go with a set agenda for the weekend of training. They feel prepared. They feel ready to go. So then they can max out their 16 hours that they get here with us and get caught up.
Thank you for saying how our full-timers support DSGs. I think it's a two-way street, though. How do DSG support our full-timers?
What's amazing is when our DSG team shows up, they show up with all the other skills that they bring from the outside. I mean, I have a first sergeant that works in the medical field out there, you know, and so like your skills, your decision-making, all the stuff that you do on a normal basis can get applied here and provide a different perspective that we may not look at because we get in the routine of a day-to-day and trying to prepare and go into all the meetings that we got to go to and all that stuff. So bringing those outside perspectives are really good. Our DSG staff, they show up with energy, enthusiasm. They show up ready to learn, and that's amazing. That's even DSGs that have served for, you know, 10, 15 years still show up willing and ready to learn all the time. And you can't ask for any more because we're constantly throwing different training, whether it be our job training or additional training that we have to do or whatever. They show up and knock it out. It's amazing how much that we can do with, like Major Shelton said, the 16 hours that we get with them once a month.
Right. Major Pence, you actually hit on this before. What does the path to a commander look like? And I really appreciate the three of you being all in prior enlisted and actually learned today this morning that probably 80% of our commanders on base are prior enlisted. So we really get a twofold look at both sides of the spectrum and try not to forget either one, right? But what does a path to commander look like? You already hit on it. You had two routes and you picked the commander route. Tell us a little bit about that.
The biggest thing is risk. How much risk are you willing to take? I think that when I was sitting down with the wing commander at that time and looking at my flight paths, that flight path jump to the officer side was a big risk. I was a AGR at the time, enlisted. I was an E6. You know, I had a pretty comfortable lifestyle that I could have stayed in. And I knew that with taking the officer route and, you know, potentially going to a command someday, that it was going to be a big risk. And so I talked with my family quite a bit about it, tried to figure out what we were willing to do. Was I willing to go out in the civilian world as a DSG officer and work out there and then come back? You never know. But in my case, I put my mind to it. I knew that it was a goal for me, continued to pursue it. It didn't mean that there weren't bumps along the way and frustrations. And I applied for full-time officer positions that I didn't get leading up to where it was at. But if it's a desire of someone to become a commissioned officer from the enlisted force, I highly encourage it. Don't be afraid of the risk, because being a commander, I mean, when you're here, a lot of the stuff you do is managing, mitigating, and taking risks. And that's what I believe good commanders do, is that they're willing to put their name on the line and take the risk on behalf of their squadron so that that squadron can move forward and do bigger and better things.
Yeah. I think the train applauded you too. So it agreed with you. I agree. So what I heard you say was we all need to take risks. So maybe we'll get some paperwork pre-filled out, because I'm going to start taking some risks when it comes to this kind of stuff. What's something you wish someone would have told you before you had to learn it as a commander? And I don't know the airman that asked this, but when I put it on here, I really appreciated it.
I had to think about this one for a while. And I think if I had known before as a commander, you don't realize, fortunately and unfortunately, how much you will use the helping agencies here at the wing until you become a commander. And I get the opportunity when they do their briefs, like the SARC does the brief, or the DPH does the brief, or chaplains. I always tell people, because they offer their cell phone numbers, I said, just put it in your phone. Like, you'll never know whether or not you need it or not. And I can't tell you how many times I've had to call, unfortunately and fortunately, call them, and they always answer. They're always there to help me and my airmen work through whatever those situations. And I didn't know how much I would need them. And I didn't know how much I would really appreciate those relationships and those partnerships that I have from them. They do amazing work in their respective fields and are really there to help our airmen. And I really appreciate that. The other thing that I wish I would have known, more is that words matter. Your airmen will remember things that you say years ago and will remind you that you said them to them. And so, you know, that's something that, you know, as you mature, you learn, like, hey, my words do matter. I need to choose them wisely to make sure that, you know, one, you're not tasking when you're asking a question or whatever, but additionally also that, you know, when you're giving feedback or, you know, you're talking about a situation, that, you know, how are they viewing the feedback that you're giving them, and are you being holistic, are you making sure that you're being supportive? So those are, I think, would be the two things.
If words matter, how do you come up with your words? What are you guys doing to read, learn, listen to, and take care of yourself personally?
I'm a big podcaster. I love different podcasts. I love listening to people who are smarter than me. You know, it helps you find some of those words, those encouraging things to say. So I feel like it's important to do that. Some of those different books, I can give you a whole list of books that we love to read, or I love to read. I'm a big fan of The Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willick. I love him. You know, he has so many different perspectives. Turn the Ship Around is another book I really love. That's super helpful as a new commander, you know, in an organization, because your organization may not be at the point where it's, like in his example of his book, where it was doing not well, but it's helpful in, like, figuring out, you know, how do you want to communicate to your airmen and how do you want to motivate them. So those are some of the things I use.
What about either of you?
I think the biggest thing for me in kind of shaping that is having that kind of standard for myself, and that kind of allows me to, you know, not get caught up in like two sides, because if that direction works, and you know, my biggest thing is like, I really want to create a fair atmosphere and one where people are empowered to make those decisions. So if I can center stuff on that, it helps kind of drive that conversation a little bit easier for my part. But again, like, it, there are times when you put your foot in your mouth and you kind of got to move on, and sometimes you're going to be wrong. And that's just the reality of life. And that's not unique to being a commander, that,
right,
you know, we're all going to make mistakes. It happens. It's how you handle those and how you move forward that really do matter. And some mistakes are bigger than others, and we deal with them and we move on. But that setting kind of that personal standard and then trying to help carry that personal standard over with your people, at least provides expectation and kind of drives that conversation. And there's always, there's no shortage of smarter people out there, and it's always great to hear their perspectives, because
right,
they have things that you just don't think about, you know, or maybe just an angle that you don't think about. I was driving up here and I listened to a thing. I was listening to like YouTube in the background. I was not watching it, just to be clear. But if you want like a super short summation of like kind of leadership and the military specifically, like, there is a YouTube video. It's the true story behind Leaders Eat Last. It's only 15 minutes. So if you don't want to listen to the 9.5 hour book, like, that'll give you a really good primer to what it is and kind of why. And it's much more military based, but there are certainly lessons, especially in the book, that apply kind of everywhere. So
yeah, it's one of my favorites too. Yeah.
He's a popular one.
Major Pence.
I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I'm kind of all over the place. Like, part of your question there was, how do you like fill your own mind? I got to fill it with multiple different things. So a lot of the books that Major Shelton referred to, I like the military leadership books, and when my mindset is there, I'll go there. Sometimes I'm listening to Christian leadership books, because I think of our spiritual foundation is very important as commanders, to know, to have that perspective with some of the challenges that we deal with. And then I swing all the way over to golf books. Like, I have a passion for golf, but it's funny because even these golf books can have some application. A lot of it is about the mental mindset going after a goal. And so it's applicable. And then I go into some weird like fiction and nonfiction areas that I just really love. So at any point in time on my phone, I probably have 3 or 4 audiobooks going, and I jump in between them based on where I am at the time and what I need. So if it's something that is easy to listen to, I'll listen to like a fiction story or, you know, something like that. It just, that I enjoy. But yeah, I think you find that people who succeed in any organization are readers and audiobook and podcasts. They're always seeking more information. I think that it's really hard for us to progress in our growth, maturity, and mentality without having additional perspectives brought in.
I get into plenty of things that are not leadership related as well. Like, a lot of sci-fi books on my Audible right now, and I enjoy them. They're a nice way to take a break. But I learned just as much from when I was racing triathlons as I ever have from a book about myself and about other people. And it really is applicable. So whatever works for you, if there's something out there you want to learn, like, learn it. I'm teaching myself how to play the drums right now. It's challenging, but it's going to be fun. So one day, maybe I'll be good at it.
So how does that shape what your personal vision statement is, or a personal mission statement, what you're learning, what you're getting from your team, your family? Do you guys have a personal vision statement for yourself or your group or unit?
I definitely do for our unit. I was sitting there thinking about a personal vision statement. I think I bought this sign that's been in my office for a couple years now, which is, create the things you wish existed. And I would say that probably encapsulates a lot of what I try to do, both personally and professionally within our organization. If it's not there, then what do we need to do to get to that? And I kind of, when we created our goals within within my new squadron, you know, where did we want to be? And that was one of the things I talked about with the chiefs and the flight chiefs. Where do we want to be at in a year from now? Where do we want to be at in 5 years? And that's kind of the same thing, though, personally, too. You know, where do I want to be at in a year? Where do I want to be at in 5 years?
Yeah, I definitely have a vision statement for the squadron. I kind of alluded to it earlier, but I want our airmen to be the most prepared they can be to fight our nation's toughest battles. So that's where we're at for the squadron. Personally, I don't have a personal vision statement, but I just went through some training that was really cool that talked about an I am statement. So when you meet someone new, you usually say, hey, I'm, you know, Cody, I'm the MOF flight commander, whatever. But we're not defined by our jobs. And so this training went back to say, who are you in your I am statement? And that shows the strengths that you have. And then so you can lead from those strengths, and then you build your team around you with additional strengths. So it's been a little bit. I actually used my I am statement in my major board. Major Shelton was on that. And when I said that, it generated a lot of questions. So hopefully I can remember it exactly. But I am a relentless encourager, a loyal wingman, and an optimistic failure who uses my skills and abilities to help others achieve their goals. And that's who I am. That's who I am and who I desire to be. And so that's kind of where I go back to, kind of like Major Shelton says that she reflects back on hers there. It's the same thing. When I need to do a self-check, am I doing that? So I thought that was an interesting perspective on that. And I use that probably more as the basis of where I try to come from with everything that I do than just a vision statement.